Information, please. Presented each week at this time by Canada Dry, famous the world over for its fine beverages. Wake up, America. Time to stump the experts and enjoy a cool, refreshing glass of Canada Dry ginger ale. Every week at this time, Canada Dry provides a set of four amazing intellects for you to use as a target. You pitch stumpers at them, and they try to pop up each time with the correct answers. Here's the way it goes. You may submit from one to three questions with the correct answers. For every question we use, whether or not it's answered correctly, the sender gets $5. And if your question stumps our board of experts, you not only get $10 more, but in addition, you receive a complete 24-volume set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Mind you, this is only if your question stumps our board of experts. Our editorial staff may reword your question a trifle. Don't worry about it. Whenever there is a duplication of questions, Information Please uses the one that was submitted first. All questions become the property of Information Please and should be addressed to Canada Dry, 1 Pershing Square, New York City. And now may I present our master of ceremonies, Mr. Clifton Fadiman, literary critic of the New Yorker magazine. Mr. Fadiman.
Ladies and gentlemen, Information Please continues in its gay, unrehearsed, and spontaneous course. Tonight, our board includes our two regulars, Franklin P. Adams, conductor of the famous Conning Tower in the New York Post, and General Wiseman, and John Kieran, the sports authority with the most preposterous memory this side of an elephant. As our guests, we welcome back the distinguished musician, composer, commentator, and all-round scholar, Deems Taylor. That takes you in, doesn't it, Deems? And the well-known author, Henry Pringle, author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning biography of Theodore Roosevelt some years ago, and of a recently published life of William Howard Taft. Now remember, for each question that's missed, Canada Dry rings up $10, and that's paid out to the sender, plus 24 volumes of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Gentlemen, we're off with a question from Ruth Morrison of Charlotte, North Carolina. Miss Morrison wants you to name five books, count them, five, the titles of which suggest astronomical bodies. Astronomical bodies. Mr. Taylor had his hand up first.
The Moon and Sixpence.
The Moon and Sixpence by whom?
Somerset Maugham.
Somerset Maugham, that's one. Now, I think, Mr., you had your hand up, Mr. Pringle?
Stars Fell in Alabama.
Stars Fell in Alabama. Who wrote
it? Carl Kammer.
Carl Kammer, yes. Two very good books. Mr. Adams.
My Son, My Son.
Oh. You want me to count that twice, Mr. Adams? I'll have to let it go because Mr. Adams can outstare me.
My son.
I refuse to spell it. Who wrote it, by the way, Mr. Adams?
Mm-hmm.
Anyone know who wrote My Son, My Son? Well, who, you know, who
Howard
wrote My Son? Give me half of it.
Howard.
Beg pardon?
Howard somebody.
No, I don't think it was. I've forgotten for the moment.
Howard, yes.
Maybe it was Howard. All right, we'll come back to it. That gives us three.
Howard, and last name begins with T.
Kite.
Let's have two more titles of books. That would include plays if they were published later on. Mr. Kieran?
This Frenchman, Exupéry, or whatever his name is.
Exupéry?
Yes.
Yes.
This latest book of his, Wind, Sand, and Stars, isn't it?
I think that is the name of it. Very good. Yeah, I think that's right. That's four. Mr. Adams has another one for us.
Stars Fell on Alabama.
When did you come in, Mr. Adams? I think Mr. Pringle gave us that a little while ago. Now, you ought to listen to Mr. Pringle.
I wasn't listening.
All right, Mr. Taylor.
The Sun Also Rises.
The Sun Also Rises. Very good. Who wrote it?
Ernest Hemingway.
Yeah, Ernest Hemingway. And there are many others that you might have mentioned. Let me see. No Star Is Lost, a novel by James T. Farrell, would be one. All This and Heaven, too. I suppose Heaven is, by extension, a kind of astronomical body. Perhaps there are many others that you might have thought of and that our audience is no doubt thinking of. Here's another question coming from Kay Gordon of San Francisco, California. It consists of four parts, and you have to get all of them correct. Gentlemen, John Marshall was Secretary of State and Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, as you remember. Name a later man who held both offices. Mr. Kieran.
Charles Evans Hughes.
That's quite correct. Quite correct, Mr. Kieran. Charles Evans Hughes, and I don't think you can name another who held both those offices. Now, Martin Van Buren was governor of New York, and he was vice president of the United States. Name a later man who filled these positions. Mr. Taylor.
Theodore Roosevelt.
Theodore Roosevelt. Would there be any other, Mr.? Can you think of any, Mr. Pringle?
I think there was not.
No, I think Theodore Roosevelt would be the only possible answer. William Gibbs McAdoo was Secretary of the Treasury and later a senator. Name a later man who held these two positions. Mr. Kieran had his hand up first. Do you want to take it down, Mr. Kieran?
Yeah, I think I'll pull it down.
That's the first time you've pulled it down for a long time. I hardly recognize the gesture. Any guesses, gentlemen? Secretary of the Treasury and later a senator. Name one who held those two positions. Not necessarily in that order, though I think in that order in this case.
Can we make a guess?
Oh, and there's not the slightest doubt that you're going to do
well,
something.
Well, I mean, we'll be ruined if we don't say something.
Yeah, we're going
yeah,
to.
Yeah, say something. Say something.
Was Carter Glass ever.
That's
second...
right, that's
all
right,
right.
Mr. Kieran. Had you been holding us in reserve all this time just to build us up? Carter Glass is right, and I think that's the hardest of these four. Here is the last. James A. Garfield was senator from Ohio and president of the United States. Name a later man who held these positions. Mr. Adams had his hand up.
Warren G. Harding.
Warren G. Harding, I think, would be the only possible answer. That gives us all. Very good. Here's one for H. Prince of this city. Identify the person or thing referred to in the following light opera titles. The first is Floridora. What is Floridora? Floridora. Now, Mr. Taylor.
This is a pure guess. I think it's an island.
It is an island. Know where it is?
Well, around.
In
the shade of the sheltering palms.
It would be where, do you think, Mr. Adams?
I don't know.
Well, in the Philippines, and the action of the first act of that operetta takes place there. I think also it's the name of a perfume which has some place in the story. Do you remember, Mr. Adams?
No.
Your memory goes back.
No, before my time.
Really, before yours?
Believe it or not.
Not. Roberta. What is Roberta, Mr. Taylor? That's all right. You can change the name if you wish.
Not Roberta.
Remove the horse from
Cousin Yester. I'm thinking of another current operetta. Roberta is a couturier.
Yes, that's rather fancy.
Well, a dressmaker.
Yes, that's all right. Much better. A dressmaker, what city?
Oh, come now.
Name a city.
I quibble over cities. Minneapolis.
No, Paris.
Paris.
I like a good quibble now and then. It's the name of the dressmaking shop in Paris. And, of course, it's involved in the musical comedy or light opera by Jerome Kern and Otto Harbach, Roberta, which later was made into a movie, I think, wasn't it, Taylor?
Yes, with Irene Dunne.
Madame Sherry. What does that mean to you, gentlemen? I think this goes back quite a long time. Certainly before my own time. Mr. Adams, I'm kind of depending on you for this one. Madame Sherry.
Does I don't it... know where it was. It was a play with Lena Abarbanel.
I'm very glad to get that information, but I want to know what Madame Sherry means exactly. Well, it was a...
I don't know.
It was a light opera in which there's an Irish landlady who was presented as Madame Sherry by Edward Sherry, a man about town. He fooled somebody into believing that she was Madame Sherry.
Certainly
and she
sounds
really was an Irish
like
landlady.
A light opera.
Doesn't sound very light.
Not
but...
too light.
Mr. Taylor, what is the... I've always wanted to know this, and you're the man to tell me. Mr. Taylor, what is the difference between a light opera and a musical comedy?
Well, partly the talent.
Which way? I mean, I've always wanted to know where one becomes the other, and the other becomes
well,
the one.
Well, there's a very faint line. I should say that in a light opera, all of the songs have some... if only dim, relation to the story.
Yeah.
In a musical comedy, many of them are stuck in where they'll do the most good.
I see. Well, I think that makes it all perfectly clear, and I will know how to listen to a musical comedy next time. We were supposed to get 2 out of 3 on that one, and we did. The next question comes from Celia Higley of Blassburg, Pennsylvania, and it involves your knowledge of some well-known poems, 3 of them. The following lines from well-known poems describe the manner in which certain characters walked or moved. Name the character and name the poem. First question. Who staggered down the stairs? Who staggered down the stairs? Mr. Kieran.
The captain. We are lost, the captain shouted as he staggered down the stairs.
That's right. Do you know where those famous lines come from?
By a poem by James T. Fields.
This is Mr. Adams reciting, and reciting very correctly. Yes, James T. Fields. You couldn't give us another line or two, could you, Mr.
We were crowded in the cabin. Not a soul would dare to sleep. It was midnight on the waters, and a storm was on the deep.
Oh, that's right. That's right. And do you remember what happened after the captain shouted and staggered down the stairs? Remember what his little daughter did? This is the most affecting part. Mr. Taylor.
Isn't there something about 'tis a fearful thing at midnight to hear
in
the...
winter.
Winter?
To be shattered by the blast.
Captain shouting, cut away the mast!
Yes, that wasn't what I meant.
The daughter said, isn't God upon the waters just as well upon the land?
Just the same as on the land.
All right, why don't we...
Well, this quarrel could go on all night. I shall read the stanza. But his little daughter whispered as she took his icy hand, isn't God upon the ocean just the same as on the land?
I got about 40 on that, didn't I?
I think you did fairly well. Now, gentlemen, who glittered when he walked? Who glittered when he walked? This is not so easy. Who glittered when he walked? It's a poem by no means as famous as the one which we've just had a little lesson on. I'm sorry, gentlemen. It's a famous short poem, I think in the sonnet form, by Edwin Arlington Robinson, and it's called Richard Cory. Remember that now? Remember it, Mr. Kieran?
It's after my time.
I'm afraid it is. Well, it's a very good poem, Mr. Adams. You should read it. And it's about a gentleman who apparently was as... well-favored and popular and well-set-up as any gentleman could be, and everybody was very envious of him. He glittered when he walked, and one day, as I remember in the poem, Richard Cory went back to his home and put a bullet through his head. Do you remember that now, Mr. Kieran? Mr. Adams, sorry.
Sounds like a lizard.
Well, you read the poem. Now, the third and last of these questions. Who goes hoppity-hop? Who goes hoppity-hop? Mr. Pringle.
Bunny Rabbit.
That's very cute, but this isn't the right answer. Mr. Taylor.
Christopher Robin, I
Christopher Robin, yes. There's a real distinction between Bunny Rabbit and Christopher Robin. Remember the poem in which he goes hoppity-hop, Mr. Taylor?
It's all yours, Adams.
Remember, Christopher Robin goes
hoppity-hop. I know he goes hoppity-hop.
Hoppity-hoppity-hop.
Yeah.
Whenever I tell him politely to stop it, he says he can't possibly stop.
Yeah.
From A.A. Milne's famous poem. That's right. We got 2 out of 3, but that's not enough. That's going to cost Canada Dry $10 plus a set of Encyclopedia Britannica. Now, gentlemen, here is a question about certain famous groups or parties in American history. M. Hetker of Hasbrook Heights, New Jersey, sends this one in. How do the following groups get their names? The first is Tammany Hall. Tammany Hall. How did Tammany Hall get its name? Mr. Pringle.
The Society of Tammany, which was a patriotic organization, had nothing to do with politics.
Yes, but how did it get its name?
They adopted their name after the Tammany chieftain, the Indian named Tammany.
Yes, that's what I wanted to know. After an Indian named Tammany. The Society's building, Tammany Hall, was leased to the political club, which was supposed to be distinct, I believe, from...
It had nothing to do with
nothing
politics,
to do with
nor
it.
Ever has.
That's right. Now, Bull Moose, which is perhaps a little easier. Bull Moose, how did the party... Bull Moose Party, get its name. Don't tell me it was named after Bull Moose, Mr. Kieran. What were you going to tell me?
It was named after Theodore Roosevelt.
Oh, why?
Well, he was given, he was ticketed with a large number of animal names, and that was the emblem. By the way, I mean, he was called Bwanatumba in Africa and the Bull Moose in American politics and all that sort of thing.
He was after the Bull Moose Party got the name of Bull Moose, but why was it selected? You're all right so far, Mr. Kieran.
Well, they broke away from the herd, for one thing.
No, that's rather clever. I'm not sure that it's correct. Mr. Pringle? Mr. Pringle,
I think Mr. Kieran's bullying about it. What it really was that Theodore came home one day and said, I feel as strong as a bull moose.
That's right. That's right. Why did you let Mr. Kieran just batter around that way?
I thought he was having fun.
Along, Pringle. Well, I think between the two of you, you certainly got that correct. Now, gentlemen, how did the Brain Trust get its name? Now, there's been a certain amount of controversy about this, and I'm going to accept only one answer. Mr. Adams.
I think it was given to the some helpers, men who were down in Washington, and I think it was conferred on them by Mr. James Kieran of the New York Times at
yes,
the time.
Yes, that's quite right. Not to be confused with Mr. John Kieran of Information.
On au contraire.
Yes, James Kieran is Mr. Kieran's brother, And
did you know that, John?
I knew it.
Yeah. Oh, you didn't tell us that. And I think there are some other theories of how the term brain trust arose, but apparently Mr. James M. Kieran did actually use the term, though in the plural, the brains trust once, referring to the group of Columbia professors who were Mr. Roosevelt's advisors in his first campaign. The authority for that, by the way, is Stevenson's A Book of Quotations, page 1555, number 6, in case anyone wishes to quarrel with us. Now, so far, we fish around in our change pocket and find that Canada Dry has lost $10 and one set of encyclopedia. And now, Mr. Cross, it's your turn.
Thank you, Mr. Fadiman. The other day, I decided to read what the Encyclopedia Britannica had to say on the subject of ginger ale. In the text of the interesting article, I found the following sentence. I quote, "The Jamaican variety of ginger yields the finest flavored beverages." Now, of course, the Jamaican variety is the only ginger ever used in the making of Canada Dry. And within the Canada Dry bottle that's become so well known all over the world is found the exact flavor and bouquet of this superior ginger from the tropics. Canada Dry employs a special process whereby the delicate taste, essence, and aroma are transferred without the slightest loss from the sun-cured ginger root to the sparkling ginger ale. Yes, Mother Nature and modern science work hand in hand in the creation of Canada Dry. And all you have to do to enjoy the delicious, refreshing result is to write Canada Dry Ginger Ale at the very top of tomorrow's shopping list. Have it ready to serve when your children come home.
Mr. Cross.
Take a heap of ginger ale to make a house at home.
Jim, Mr. Adams. The story of Mr. Cross's curious excursion into the Encyclopedia Britannica was told in precisely 61 seconds, plus one extra second by Mr. Adams. The next question is a rather tricky one. It comes to us from Mr. C.O. Partridge of Chicago, Illinois. Listen attentively, gentlemen. What have the following items in common? One, a lottery ticket. Two, a bottle of whiskey. Three, a live rattlesnake. What do they have in common? Mr. Pringle.
They're all dangerous.
Well, I don't know that I'd say that necessarily about a lottery ticket. Not if you win.
But if you lose.
If you lose, yes. But why look on the sad face of things?
But I do, characteristically.
No, that isn't the answer. It is an answer, but not the answer.
May I ask, what is the second object?
You've never heard of it, Mr. Taylor. It's a bottle of whiskey. A bottle of whiskey. It's
Taylor
a sort of...
Whiskey.
How do you spell it?
Well, it's a kind of brownish liquid that comes in a tallish bottle.
Oh, I know, yes.
You may have seen them.
Uh-huh.
Yep. Well, it is a tough question. Anyone you want to guess? Mr. Kieran, you're good at guessing.
A live rattlesnake, you said.
A live rattlesnake. Does that make it clearer to you, Mr. Taylor?
No, but at least I don't have to worry about studying a dead rattlesnake.
All right. The answer is that a lottery ticket, a bottle of whiskey, and a live rattlesnake are all inadmissible to the United States mails, which is a bit snobbish.
Why?
Inadmissible to the United States mail.
That's discrimination, isn't it?
It may be discrimination, but it's the answer to the question. And Mr. Partridge, for thinking up this very ingenious question, gets $10 plus a set of Encyclopedia Britannica. Now, gentlemen, get your mind off that rattlesnake, Mr. Taylor.
But there are but you wouldn't be admissible to the United States mails.
Well, which of those three do you think... I think that's an ad hominem argument, Mr. Taylor. Next question from E. Henry of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. This is a musical one. You're going to listen to a medley consisting of parts of four familiar compositions. Can you identify them? Disentangle them. Now, listen carefully, gentlemen. We'll run through the entire medley. How about it, Mr. Taylor?
I rather hate these, but I can give you one and three. Number one is Myself When Young from Liza Lehmann's cantata in a Persian Garden.
That's quite correct, Mr. Taylor.
Number three is My Heart Opens at Your Sweet Voice from Saint-Saëns' Samson and Delilah.
That's right. That's two.
Now, the other two
you want to turn
more
those
popular strains, I leave to the younger element here.
All right. Now, will the younger element kindly respond?
I can't remember. Play them again.
Would you like to have it played again?
Over and over.
Well, I think we can have it do it once more. Sound just the same. Pretty tough, I imagine.
I surrender.
All right, Mr. Adams surrenders. Do you surrender, Mr. Kieran, Mr. Taylor?
I know that second song.
I think you do. I think you do.
I just can't.
What were you going to, guess, Mr. Pringle?
I don't know it, and I can't remember the name.
You had. Well, that's a very nice answer, thank you. That covers the ground thoroughly. The other two songs are Swanee, George Gershwin's Swanee, which was intertwined in that medley, and Look for the Silver Lining by Jerome Kern. Get it now, Mr. Taylor?
Fair enough.
Not very easy, perhaps. $10 goes to Mr. Henry of Philadelphia, plus a set of the encyclopedia. Now, gentlemen, Gertrude Carroll of Brooklyn, New York, sends this one in. To prove the oft-repeated phrase that history repeats itself, which you may have heard, state the event in the 20th century that parallels the following. The first is the Battle of Trafalgar in 1805. The Battle of Trafalgar. What event in the 20th century more or less parallels that battle? Mr. Kieran.
Battle of Jutland.
Battle of Jutland in 1917. How would you say it paralleled it, Kieran?
Well, it settled the question of open sea supremacy for capital ships.
Yes, and in whose favor did it settle it?
England.
Yes, although I believe Germany still believes, and many of her apologists do believe, that she really won that battle.
She might have won the battle, but she didn't gain the supremacy of the sea.
No, but she made a strategic retreat. I believe, however, it did prove that Napoleon, in the case of Trafalgar, Napoleon couldn't beat Britain at sea, and in 1917, the same thing was proved of Germany as against England. Now, the Congress of Vienna took place in 1815. In the 20th century, what historical event would you say paralleled the Congress of Vienna? Mr. Pringle?
I would say Versailles.
I would say Versailles, too, and why would you say that, Mr. Pringle?
Because I think it confused the European situation more than it had been confused before.
But do you think that Versailles is going to confuse Europe for 100 years as Congress of Vienna did?
It
looks pretty bad. Well, in both instances, of course, the major European powers met to divide...
The swag.
...an empire. Yes, the swag, as you so neatly put it, Mr. Taylor. Now, in 1808, what is called the Peninsular War was fought. The Peninsular War. In what country? Mr. Kieran?
That's all right. He said it.
All right, Mr. Taylor, I didn't hear you.
I got as far as the first syllable of Spain.
Spain there ain't no right. Other syllables, Taylor.
You can't fool Mr. Adams.
Well, if you'd heard me saying Spain, you would have.
How about the Spain?
Yeah.
How about the 20th century parallel? That's rather easy. Mr. Taylor, go ahead.
You mean that Spanish Revolution?
That Spanish Revolution, as some call it, the recent Civil War in Spain.
Yes.
And what made the parallel even more pronounced is the fact that there was foreign intervention in both cases, was there not?
Yes.
That gives us 3 out of 3. History not only repeats itself, apparently, but doesn't improve with repetition. The next question from Theodore Buschemeyer of Louisville, Kentucky, is about the word dry. I might not resist a temptation for a plug, gentlemen. I might ask you, why is Canada dry? None of you know the answer, and I'm going to tell it to you. Because when it was introduced on the market, it was less sweet than the generally accepted ginger ales, just as we make a distinction between dry and sweet wines.
We all know that.
We all know that. All right, but I want to tell it to you anyway. Now, if you all know that, perhaps you can tell me what dry farming is, what dry ice is, and what dry cleaning is. Mr. Kieran, dry farming?
I'll begin at the wrong end.
All right, dry cleaning.
Dry cleaning is getting out the spots on a suit with some kind of spot remover. I've forgotten the exact chemical reaction involved, but it merely spreads
destroys
out.
Destroys the suit is the chemical.
No, no, that's something else does it.
That's Moore's.
Dry ice is...
That's about right. Cleaning without the use of water.
Darkness.
Which is what my 8-year-old son generally does, as far as I can figure out. And dry ice would be
dry what? Dry ice is solidified CO2, carbon dioxide.
That's right. That's quite correct.
And what's the other?
Dry farming.
Well, dry farming.
If you want to throw this to some of the farmers here.
Dry farming is farming without the use of irrigation.
Without the use of irrigation, yes. Principally by what methods, would you say?
Well, the ordinary methods of plowing, sowing, harrowing, and finally reaping.
Well, that's rather general. A rather special methods which conserve soil moisture or by the use of drought-enduring crops, I think. The crops that resist dryness particularly. Well, we got all on that. Miss Eva No of Plainfield, New Jersey, sends in the following. Give four common expressions that are used to describe a state of mental or emotional upset and which in themselves picture physical distress. If that seems too hard to you, I'll give you an example. Cut to the quick would be one. Cut to the quick. Mr. Kieran, another one?
I lost my head.
Yes, that'd be very good. I lost my head. True. Mr. Taylor?
Sore as a crab.
Sore as a crab. Seems to me perfectly all right. Very good. That's two. Mr. Kieran again.
I was weak in the knees.
Weak in the knees. Yeah, that's all right. Very good. Three. Mr. Taylor.
Oh, you can have mad as a hornet or a wet hen.
I can?
Yes, you can be.
Generous of you, Mr. Taylor. Which in themselves picture physical distress. Yes,
or she cut him dead.
Pardon?
She cut him dead.
She cut him dead would be very good. Stabbed by jealousy, frozen by a glance, any of those metaphors.
Transfixed by admiration.
Transfixed by admiration. Very good. Milton and Lieberman of Paterson, New Jersey, want to know the following. In what occupations or industries are the following measurements used? The first is a hand, the second a cord, the third a scruple, and the fourth a stick. A hand is used where? Mr. Pringle.
In horses, with relation to horses.
Yes, tell us a little more about it, Springer.
Well,
is
I mean,
a hand?
If a horse is so big, it's 14 and a half.
Yes, but
hands.
How big is it, then?
I don't know.
How big is a hand? Mr. Kieran?
4 inches.
4 inches. Oh, the first time you get on a horse, your hand is more like a foot. A cord would be what, gentlemen? Mr. Adams?
Wood.
Yes, lumber. It's a measure of lumber. A scruple, gentlemen, a scruple. In what trade is that used? Mr. Kieran?
Jewelry, weighing.
Well, I think not so much
well,
in jewelry.
Well, druggist.
Druggists use it. Yes, it's 20 grains. A stick would be what? Oh, well, of course, everyone knows that. Mr. Pringle.
It's a measure of type.
Yes, and what does it measure?
It's about 2 inches.
Well, a square of print of the width of the column would be quite right. That gives us 4 out of 4. Now, the man with the cash register tells me that Canada Dry has paid out a total of $30 and 3 sets of the encyclopedia. Mr. Cross wants a word with you, and then I'll be back with the lineup for next week.
On many occasions, we have told you that Canada Dry's scientifically developed process, pinpoint carbonation, keeps sparkling Canada Dry water fresh and full of life for over 24 hours after the bottle had been opened. On last week's program, we demonstrated this fact by reopening a bottle before the microphone that had first been opened more than 24 hours before. Now, we would like you to keep this demonstration in mind, for whenever the occasion calls for a club soda, serve Canada Dry water. It adds flavorful goodness to your drink, and you will have the assurance that the final sip will be just as fresh, just as tasty as the first. This is the reason that wherever smart people gather, you will always find sparkling Canada Dry water the popular favorite. Now here's Mr. Fadiman.
Canada Dry thanks you, Mr. Taylor and Mr. Pringle, for coming down tonight. Now next week, Mr. Adams, Mr. Kieran, and Mr. Levant will be on hand. And as our guest, we'll present Walter B. Pitkin, psychologist and educator, known to millions as the author of Life Begins at 40 and many other books. To our listeners, we say, please send your questions along. If you have a stumper to stump our board of experts, let's have it. There are $5 in it for you if we use your question, and if it stumps the experts, you get another 10, plus a complete set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. So you can win this new prize in addition to $15. Send your letters with the questions and the correct answers to Information, Please, 1 Pershing Square, New York City.
Your neighborhood stores have Canada Dry ginger ale and sparkling water in convenient sizes for every occasion. The 12-ounce medium-sized bottle sells 3 for 25 cents, plus bottle deposit. And remember, too, you'll find Canada Dry ginger ale and sparkling water at clubs, restaurants, hotels, and wherever fine beverages are sold. This is Milton Cross saying good night for Canada Dry. Until next week at this time.